Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Steve Grace, a local marine educator and naturalist. We'll be talking about a very special place out in the Cape George area, a lost wilderness right here on the Quimper Peninsula, and about efforts to protect this very special place. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me here, and welcome back from Indonesia.
Oh, well, thank you. But before we go to the lost wilderness, let's hear this week's mystery sound. This week's mystery sound is, in fact, a bit of a cheat. I do not really expect anyone to be able to identify these creatures. They are definitely not local. But I did just return from a six-week trip to Indonesia. I heard this sound on a small island off the far northwest coast of Papua New Guinea, and I just had to share it with listeners. The identity will be revealed later in the show. Picking up a couple of observations and news items, and I'm going to ask Steve to help out with this. So for recent observations, I have relied on Paula Vanderheel's report of a recent Admiralty Audubon field trip along the Milo Curry section of the Larry Scott Trail. She reported seeing a good variety of birds, a total of 28 species. Along the trail, birders came upon brushy mixed pine and alder, and there were lots of golden-crowned kinglets, ruby-crowned kinglets, Hutton vireo, Pacific wren, black-capped and chestnut-sided chickadees, common ravens, spotted towhees, American robins, and varied thrush. And at the farm pond, they had great viewing of trumpeter swan, Canada geese, northern shoveler, gadwall, American widgeon, green-winged teals, mallards, canvasback, ring-necked duck, and bufflehead. She also reports seeing great blue heron and even more robins enjoying the red berries on the madrona trees. So I'm actually now going to ask Steve, who's been around, have you observed anything recently that you'd like to share?
Recently, I saw a great horned owl in the Quimper Lost Wilderness. I was pretty excited about that. What I'm really excited about, though, is while I saw that owl, I was out looking for mushrooms. It's that time of year, right?
Yeah.
The film Fantastic Fungi is playing at the Rose Theater, and it's that time of year when all sorts of fantastic fungi are fruiting in the forest.
Oh, I didn't know that. Thank you.
So I've been out looking for those, and my favorite, this one I've come across recently, it's called green stain fungus, or blue stain fungus, or elf cup fungus. That's my favorite of its common names, right?
So that's this a lovely
little,
name.
Yeah, cute little mushroom fruiting body that made somebody think about, well, maybe a little elf is drinking out of that. Its scientific name is Chlorosaboria. It's a beautiful, beautiful, vivid green color, almost a metallic blue-green. It's absolutely arresting, its color. It almost looks artificial. The first time I saw it, it stains wood and turns that wood a beautiful green color. And the first time I saw it, I thought it was like maybe metallic spray paint that some miscreant in the forest had been spray painting the wood. But far from it. It's actually this natural fungus that stains the wood a beautiful color. And I did a little poking around, a little investigation, and found out it has a wonderful history. It's been used by artists for several hundred years. It was especially popular during the Italian Renaissance. They would take that green stained fungus wood, and craftsmen during the Italian Renaissance would chip off little pieces of it, use slivers of it to make these beautiful wooden inlaid creations, which you can see if you go to Florence, Italy, you'll see these beautiful creations from the Italian Renaissance used with that green stained fungus. And one other aspect of this that's really intriguing, the same fungus species, scientists started looking at it because they were curious about how its pigment could stay so stable. Those creations in the Italian Renaissance, they have the same beautiful green color that they had 500 years ago. So scientists at Oregon State University right now are investigating the potential of that green stained fungus to use as a semiconductor material in electronic applications, potentially replacing silicon. So,
some of you listeners may remember that last February, Steve was on Nature Now, and we talked about the lost wilderness that Steve had recently at that point discovered. And today, I wanted to ask Steve to come back and give an update on efforts to protect this treasure. first, let's start with some background. As a reminder to folks who might have heard that program, or if you didn't, to give a little bit more background, Steve, just briefly share the story of how you stumbled upon this lost wilderness.
Right. So about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, I bought a house in kind of out by the Cape George area in a place called Ocean Grove. And I immediately started exploring my neighborhood, seeing what was in the local environs. There's some state land there that's managed by the Department of Natural Resources. I started exploring in the forest there, looking for trails. There really weren't any established trails. So I just kind of followed some game trails through the forest and stumbled upon a pretty interesting stand of trees that looked a lot different from the second growth that were surrounding it. It was sort of this hidden grove of forest that looked an awful lot like old growth forest. It looked like a very nice example, relatively intact example of rain shadow old growth forest.
So you say it looked different. What were the clues? And while you're at it, what are the key characteristics of old growth?
Yeah, so one of the first things that caught my eye were there were clearly some very old trees in the forest. And I could tell that because I'd taken a wonderful course, like we discussed last time, the natural history course, Tidelands to Timberline, from Jefferson Land Trust.
And that is a wonderful course, by the way. I took it. Wonderful course.
Yeah. So it gave me some tools to assess the forest and also some experts that I could contact to help me understand it. So one of the first things I noticed were the old trees, and you could tell by the bark on the Douglas firs, that deeply fissured bark, the soft bark that indicates significant age. So there are definitely some old trees back there. There's a lot of woody debris on the ground, a lot of nurse logs that were decaying on the ground and releasing their nutrients to nourish the next generation of life. There was a layered canopy, a canopy that contained multiple ages of trees, multiple species, different heights, different diameters. So a really diversified forest canopy with multiple layers. And finally, I saw a lot of snags or standing dead trees, or what people oftentimes now call habitat trees. So some trees, when they die, die standing, others fall, and those standing trees provide tremendous wildlife habitat. And that makes a nice acronym, OWLS. So we had the old trees, the woody debris on the ground, the layered canopy, and the snags. So those were sort of my first clues. I kind of checked all those boxes and thought, okay, this looks significant. Now it's time to really call in the real experts and have them take a look at it.
And then also, as of last February, were there some threats to that land, or what was going on?
Yeah, there were some threats. So at first, when I found the forest, I kind of had it to myself, and it was nice. There was no sign of human presence back there. I went back.
Oh,
there
you
dozens
greedy person!
I know. I had it all to myself. I thought I have Old Fort Townsend State Park right here in my backyard. Nobody knows about it. I thought, what great good fortune I have. But one day, I was back there looking at those beautiful trees and thinking, boy, I see, you know, magnificent specimens of these ancient trees, and they're providing tremendous wildlife habitat. But other people will look at those and think, that's an awful lot of board feet of timber. That's a lot of timber revenue. And I knew that this was state trust land managed by DNR, so they do have a mandate to harvest those trees. So I gave them a call one day, and hoping that maybe that stand had been set aside for its special characteristics, but that wasn't the answer I got. I heard that there was a proposed harvest area there. So all that old growth that I was looking at, or what I suspected was old growth, was planned to be harvested. The time frame was unclear. I was being told between 1 to 7 years. But at that point, my priorities really changed. Instead of keeping that to myself and having this sort of private wilderness paradise very close to my house, instead of guarding that secret carefully, I picked up a megaphone and basically just started telling everyone who'd listen, everyone who was interested, and sharing it with them and trying to get as many eyes on the forest as possible to help me understand what it is, and also to just raise awareness about it and let people know that it's back there so they can have a say in how that public land is managed.
And a round of applause to you, Steve, for doing that. So since last February, what sort of scientific efforts have there been to figure out whether the property was in fact old growth?
you know, at first I brought in some local experts. We have so much talent in this community, as you know. So fortunately, I know people like Eric Kingfisher from Jefferson Land Trust and Fred Weinman and Ann Weinman from the Native Plant Society and Mallory Weinheimer. She's a local sustainable forestry expert, and Daryl and Lorna Smith from Western Wildlife Outreach. So I started bringing all those experts back there and getting their eyes on it. And they all suspected it was old growth and said that it was, you know, essentially functioning as old growth and sort of checked all the boxes. But the real science happened when the Department of Natural Resources agreed to do a scientific assessment of the stand before they moved forward with any kind of proposed harvest.
That was a big step.
That was a huge step, yeah, and I really appreciate them doing that. And that was sort of a long conversation that went on between me and the Department of Natural Resources and other people weighing in also and talking with them, including a retired former DNR forester, Mike Cronin, just basically, they did agree that it was worth taking a look at and sending their scientists out. And there's a department within the Department of Natural Resources called the Natural Heritage Program, and that's staffed by scientists. Those are forest ecologists and biologists, people with PhDs that do really rigorous science, and they did a tremendous job. They went out for months on end. The study went on a very long time. And they followed very rigorous scientific protocols. They sampled a lot of the trees. They did core samples so they could actually get age data. And at the conclusion of that study, which went on for a few months, they found that the stand does indeed meet the state's official criteria for old growth forest.
Wow. Okay. So we know it's old growth for sure now, and that's been confirmed by the scientists. Do we know anything more about the level of the threats? Do we know whether the area needs special protection?
Yeah, so based on the findings of the scientists, the forest managers of the Department of Natural Resources decided to establish a polygon around the old growth forest stand and defer that stand from harvest. So that's the language that's being used now, deferred from harvest. Which is great. I mean, that kind of gives, you know, gives me a, I took a big breath of relief.
Yeah, really.
But I feel like now I have to take a few more breaths, and all of us do, the community does really, and then sort of get ready for the long process of ahead. Because what we'd like is for that language to change from deferred from harvest to preserved in perpetuity. That's really what I'd like to see, and what I think a lot of other community members would like to see. I'd like to see a path forward that would allow us to ensure that we hand off that old growth forest to the next generation in a state at least as good as it is now. That's really the end game. You know, so we had a really great result there, and I'm very grateful that the Department of Natural Resources did that study. But now we need to get to that next stage where we figure out how to preserve that forest in perpetuity. So the work is far from finished.
What are the paths forward that you see?
That's where things get really complicated and really technical, and where it really needs to be a
community. Okay, I need a summary there.
Yeah, we really need a community effort at this point. There are a couple mechanisms that exist in the state. One's called reconveyance, one's called trust land transfer. And the idea is that these lands, these trust lands, at one point they were owned by the county, right? And the counties in Washington acquired a lot of lands in the 20s and 30s from tax foreclosure. So basically, those lands were forfeited. The county took over the lands. They deeded them to the state and gave the state this mandate of using those lands, those forestry lands, to generate revenue for the county. Anyway, it's all very complicated, but the idea is there is a mechanism in place called reconveyance. The county can ask for those lands back if it wants to turn them into a park. And there's another mechanism in place called trust lands transfer, where DNR would turn, you know, a property that has high conservation or recreation value and preserve it in perpetuity. And then in compensation, there's a fund that would purchase land of commensurate value somewhere else where they could continue their forest activities and continue to generate forest revenue. So these mechanisms do exist. Getting them to actually happen can be a, you know, long and complicated process. But if any community can figure out how to do that, it's certainly this one. The amount of talent here and knowledge and skill is extraordinary.
Boy, that's the case. And, you know, I'm thinking, Steve, how hopeful this conversation is and how it really reinforces that, you know, one or two people can make change. And, you know, you started it and people in the community have come forward. And I know there have been a couple of hearings in front of the county commissioners that lots of community people have gone to in support of protecting that property. If someone listening to this program has gotten their interest tweaked, is there a way that they can see the property by them for themselves?
Yeah, that brings up a great point, Nan, because at this point we have this great result where we know that it's old growth forest, that it's been deferred from harvest, so the immediate threat has sort of passed. Now so many people are going back there. I've been leading so many tours, which I love doing, because whatever effort I've put into leading the tours, I'm paid back 100-fold or 1,000-fold by meeting all these amazing people in our community and learning from them. This has been a real rich educational process for me. But now there are things happening, like there are trails that are starting to form back there, where once it was wilderness, which I sort of jokingly was referring to it at one point, but I kept getting lost back there, and they were just game paths. Now we have a well-beaten trail to me. It looks like the I-5. Some people think it's a very primitive path, but I just can't believe that there's an actual trail back there.
That's one of the downsides, isn't it?
Yeah, and people want to take their dogs back there. I'm a dog owner and a dog lover, but I'm not sure if that's in the best interest of the forest. Yesterday there was a shooting in land adjacent to there. There's some legal areas where people can discharge
shooting
firearms.
Shooting as in hunting?
Target practice?
Target practice.
And there is hunting allowed in there also. So all these things to think about, and I think it certainly isn't up to me to decide any of these things, but I would love to initiate a community conversation. It's really up to the public owns this property, and it's we've been given a real gift, and it's up to the community to decide sort of what to do with this Quimper Lost Wilderness and the land surrounding it. So, so people certainly can visit it. It's public land. That said, it's difficult to visit. There aren't any established trailheads. There aren't any established trails. There aren't really any places to park. So, maybe there'll be a day when it does become a county park, and then we decide what kind of trails and infrastructure to put in there. In the meantime, people are welcome to access it on their own if they're feeling very adventurous and want a little slice of wilderness in Port Townsend's backyard. They're also welcome to reach out to me. I love taking people back there and sharing it with them, so I'm happy to do that when I can.
So, Steve, you've been very generous, with your time on that. So I'm going to ask you to be generous again. Can you share how people would contact you?
Yeah, so probably the best way is to, they can go onto my website, tidesandtrails.org, and find my email address there, or they can simply email me at steve@tidesandtrails.org.
Lovely, lovely. Well, gosh, our time has run up. It's just a fascinating thing to think about happening here in our own community. And again, as I said, how hopeful it is that one person starting with you can make a difference, and reaching out to others, and differences can be made. So that makes me thankful on this Thanksgiving week. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Nan. Thanks for having me here. And I'd like to thank the community, the amount of support, just the outpouring of support and goodwill and people's interest has really been humbling and inspiring. It's really been a privilege to sort of accidentally just stumble into this area and have the great good fortune to be able to share it with people. It's been a wonderful experience.
With Steve's help, let's share a few upcoming events.
On Saturday, November 30th, you can extend your Thanksgiving celebration by enjoying a very special wildlife cruise. The Port Townsend Marine Science Center, in partnership with Puget Sound Express, offers a unique opportunity for an idyllic natural science adventure to learn more about our marine ecosystems and interrelationships in the Salish Sea. If the weather cooperates, the cruise will head out to Protection Island and the Protection Island Aquatic Reserve. There is a foul weather plan. If the seas are too rough, the afternoon cruise may head south toward Port Ludlow to remain in calmer waters. Check the Port Townsend Marine Science Center website for details.
Now, it's a busy month for the Admiralty Audubon Society. On Wednesday morning, December 4th, join them for birding at Point Hudson. A special feature will be to check to see if the Brant geese have returned to our area. Then, on Saturday morning, December 7th, there will be a nature walk at Fort Flagler. And then on Sunday, December the 8th, the Admiralty Audubon Society is sponsoring a work party at the Ka Tai Lagoon Nature Park. The plan is to plant native trees and shrubs. That's weather depending, of course. And the big event, the annual Christmas bird count, occurs on Saturday, December the 14th. Go to the Admiralty Audubon Society webpage for details on all these events.
December is also a busy month for the Olympic Audubon Society. On December 3rd, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society and the Dungeness River Audubon Center are offering a special lecture and discussion on the evolution of large flightless birds. This lecture and discussion is stimulated by a pioneering new book by John Riley, The Ascent of Birds, How Modern Science is Revealing Their Story, and is a part of a series on the diversity of birds. On the morning of Saturday, December 7th, one of Nature Now's favorite guests, Christy Lassen from Wild Birds and Gardener, is presenting a program on the winter care and feeding of birds as part of the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society's Backyard Birding Class series. The SQIM Dungeness Christmas Bird Count is scheduled for December 16th, with a run-up get-together planned for December 7th. Details for all these activities are on the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website.
And lastly, on Saturday, December the 7th, the Quimper Geological Society, an affiliate of the Jefferson Land Trust, is presenting a talk by Dr. Peter Ward. Dr. Ward is a paleontologist and astrobiologist at the University of Washington and is a world-renowned authority on mass extinctions, climate change, evolution, and astrobiology. His research examines the history of life on Earth over billions of years, focusing in particular on mass extinction events. In what is certain to be a thought-provoking lecture, Dr. Ward will argue that, in spite of what seems to be an ever greater technological complexity, the largest scale natural operations of the Earth are actually undergoing an unnoticed simplification, one that is already affecting geological landscapes, biodiversity, global economy, and the human population. Check the Quimper Geological Society website for details. So, back to that mystery sound. Let's hear it again. That was the sound of a colony or camp of black fruit bats. Well, to set the stage, it was in the afternoon. For the past week, we had been snorkeling amongst the islands off the northwestern tip of West Papua, an area called Raja Ampat. Our Indonesian guide said that we were in for a complete change of pace from our regular after-lunch snorkel. Soon, over the hum of our boat's engine, we heard sounds of squabbling, squeaking, cacophony. Then we saw the black fruit bats on a nearby island. Big black animals, hanging like large black sacks everywhere in the trees. Later, we went ashore to quietly and carefully watch. The roosting colony or camp of black fruit bats must have had tens of thousands of individuals, way too many to count. Black fruit bats are among the largest bat species in the world. The wingspan is more than 3 feet across, and when they flew around, it was impressive. Sometimes they are called flying foxes because their faces appear very fox-like. The black fruit bat has short black hair with contrasting reddish-brown mantle. Feeding at night, they fly great distances for nectar, pollen, and native fruits. They are native only to Australia, Papua New Guinea, and Indonesia. So, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. Thanks for listening. Our closing music is Lost in the Wilderness by Doogie McLean, a well-known Scottish singer, songwriter, composer, and musician.
You're distant, but ever so near. lost in the wilderness, alone in the wilderness. He said, I'm lost in the wilderness. Out on the city street, move with the tumbling crowd, heavy on his feet, angry and proud. I said, tell me what brings you out here.